Brian Noonan in for Roe and Anna, 720 WGN. Hear this music, get all your Irish pride up. A lot of my family still over there, and a man I'm sure they are very, very familiar with, a huge star in Ireland, coming to Chicago January 9th to the 12th at Zanies downtown. Des Bishop joins me. Des, welcome. Thanks for taking some time. Good to talk to you.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Now, I got to be honest. I was starting to watch your stuff. I was reading the bio, and I'm like, all right, I got to watch some of Des's clips that are all over YouTube and his website, desbishop.net. And I thought, this guy's going to sound exactly like all my cousins from Cork. I'm going to hear this beautiful Irish brogue lilting out through the material. I hear a guy with a New York accent, and I was a little confused. Explain.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm from Queens, but I moved to Ireland when I was 14. And, again, well, the joke I tell is how I ended up moving to Ireland was I got kicked out of St. Francis Prep in Fresh Meadows, Queens. And why I got kicked out of there was, for a 14-year-old, I had a serious problem with alcohol. So of all the places in the world to be sent, I was sent to Ireland. I guess they wanted to turn me into a Premier League alcoholic. But it's only partially true. And, yeah, no, I went to boarding school there, like a long, you know, like a silly, you know, just like a moment in our lives. And suddenly I'm in Ireland. There was no plan in advance, staying with cousins and different things when I wasn't in boarding school. And then I sort of never left. I went to college, got into comedy when I was there. Most of my comedy career has been in Ireland. So I'm really just an Irish comedian with a New York accent.
That's very nice. And you came to the people of Ireland's attention, not through stand-up initially, but through a really interesting TV show, the Des Bishop Work Experience. It sounds like a fascinating experiment. Tell people what that was.
Yeah, well, actually, so first of all, it was a series about living on minimum wage and what that experience would have been like. We filmed that in 2003, so the minimum wage in Ireland at the time was €6.35. I think at the time you would have said maybe that was about $10 an hour.
Okay.
But it was inspired by this book called Nickel and Dimed, which was actually quite popular in the United States, American journalist Barbara Ehrenreich. But she had gone undercover to sort of have the American experience of living on minimum wage. But we weren't undercover. We got permission from these places. And it was really just, well, we thought it was going to be about, like, what's it like to live on that money and the way that you get treated and all that. But because Ireland was experiencing immigration for the first time, you know, when you think of Ireland, like, certainly in America, you think of Irish people as immigrants to America. People leave Ireland, you know, but Ireland was booming at the time. And suddenly there was Chinese people and Eastern Europeans. And all the people that were doing these low-wage jobs were all people from those countries. So it became largely about that sort of first generation of Irish immigrants coming into Ireland and how they saw Ireland and how Irish people treated them. So, you know, it was at times funny, at times controversial. And, I mean, it was always interesting, but I guess because it was sort of a lucky moment in time, it was the first time where Irish people were really seeing themselves through the eyes of how they treat immigrants rather than how they got treated when they went to America or they went to England or they went to Australia.
And being an immigrant to Ireland yourself, were you surprised at how much you and the show were embraced?
Well, I mean, it literally changed my life. So, yes, I was definitely surprised. I mean, it was an overnight thing. And I guess the first episode particularly was quite controversial because it was in a kebab shop called Abracababra. And it was like a late night. I know it's funny. People always laugh at that. It's actually a chain in Ireland. It's
Is
not
it really?
Just like a one-off.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, it's like that. It was the place where after the clubs closed, everybody went. So you were getting that sort of full-on drunken person shouting at staff experience.
Yeah.
So it was pretty full on. And like, certainly the locals of the area didn't come across great in it, you know, because you're looking at that sort of 3 a.m. Nobody's looking great. So there were some people that thought it was amazing. And there's some people that were very angry that they were being shown in that light. So it generated, you know, days after. I mean, you know, Twitter didn't exist, actually.
It was probably,
I don't know if I'm happy or sad that Twitter didn't exist at that time. But it was very much at that, you know, in 2003, the controversy of the time would be on talk radio for a couple of days. So it sort of took over the zeitgeist for a couple of days, and then suddenly I was a household name.
So had you been, maybe I was mistaken, had you been doing stand-up before you did the Des Bishop Work Experience?
Oh, yeah.
All right, so you'd been
I started doing stand-up in 97. That was 2003. So I was already, I had already actually done one or two, like, small TV things up to then, which is how I got picked to do the, because it wasn't my idea. It was actually a woman from RTE came to me. with the idea. So, yeah, I wasn't totally unknown when I did it, but I was certainly unknown enough that I was able to do the job undercover. I mean, I think maybe I did 4 jobs, 1 month each, and I think maybe 3 times somebody came into one of the jobs and was like, "Hey, didn't I see you in the laughter lounge?" You know, it was I wasn't known enough that people didn't believe that I was just another guy behind the counter, you know, doing the job.
So what made you, and as I did stand-up for a long time, what was it that made you decide to go into stand-up? Because I always find that fascinating. Everybody's got their own different reason or their own different first step into it.
Yeah, I mean, I always wanted to be a performer. You know, I didn't think it would be possible that I would be able to do it for a career, but from a very young age, I kind of felt like, you know, inclined to try to make people laugh and all that. So that's a common enough story.
Sure.
And then when I was in college, I got into the Drama Society, but I was still drinking quite heavily. And coincidentally enough, I got sober after my first year, and it was an AA guy that actually pushed me towards doing stand-up rather than just doing plays, because he was actually a resident MC in this comedy club. And I didn't really believe that I could do it, you know?
Yeah.
But he got an inkling that it would suit me, and I mean, it was immediate, the sort of getting on stage, because it wasn't a long journey for me from thinking, will I do this, to trying it. It kind of was sort of thrust upon me, but once it started, it was an immediate addiction. I sort of dove in head first.
And was there, you know, every comic, of course, struggles at the beginning a little bit. Were there unique challenges being an American expat in Ireland trying to do stand-up in another country?
Nah, I mean, it was the opposite. Like, it was a crutch, really, because Irish people saw me as American, but I was educated in Ireland, so I knew a lot about Ireland. So I got laughs that I didn't really deserve, in that I was just doing very casual, simple observations about Ireland, or doing like pretty good Irish accents, and that just blew Irish people away, because they're used to like Tom Cruise far and away, like, "Oh, Shannon," you know, like terrible Irish accents from Americans.
Right.
And to them, I'm just as American as Tom Cruise. They don't really connect with me as an Irishman, especially in those early days.
Yeah.
So when I was busting out like a perfect Cork accent, I mean, they were literally like giving me standing ovations, and it wasn't that funny, but whatever. It's a scenario, you know. There's nothing you can do about it. It's just the way that I was perceived. So, but where the negative kicked in about that was, so, you know, I'm 2 or 3 years into my comedy career, and I mean, I literally think I'm Chris Rock, you know, like I think I'm the best comedian ever.
Sure.
And then I set foot outside Ireland, and I'd say 7% of what I had was funny outside of Ireland. You know, I was so reliant on that fish out of water comedy experience that I had a serious land. The first time I experienced it, I went to Edinburgh, to the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, and I was terrible. I mean, literally terrible.
Wow.
So,
and that stays with you, and you realize real quick, because people who haven't been on stage, if you're bombing, there's sometimes nothing you can do about it, and you just got to take it and then come off and figure out what you're going to do. So then I'm guessing you just started writing different things and not relying
Irish
material.
It's funny. It comes in ebbs and flows. You know, after that, I really started to think that I became obsessed about people abroad finding me funny, like as if I needed to sort of prove myself.
Yeah.
And then, you know, that was actually going pretty well. But funnily enough, when I got that series in 2003, I canceled Edinburgh in 2003, and then my life kind of changed. Like, I became like a big name in Ireland. So I actually kind of ignored the rest of the world for quite a few years. And then it wasn't until like 2008, 2009 that I started sort of. So for the last 10 years, I've been more of an international comic, but I had a bit of a break in those early sort of successful years in Ireland, you know, mainly because I just was like, I was so busy in Ireland. But, you know, particularly in the last, since I went to China, I did this Chinese project. Since I've done that, I've really not been in Ireland full time and sort of focusing more on developing outside of Ireland.
Well, in the Chinese project, it's hard enough to do stand up in your native language. So you, years ago in 2007, you decided, you know what, I'm going to learn Irish. I'm going to learn, and I'm going to do a 60-minute set in the native language of Ireland. And you did that.
Yes.
And now you've gone, then you went to China and you learned Mandarin. And you're doing stand up in Mandarin. I have a hard enough time putting together sentences in English. Do you have a natural inclination to pick up languages? It had to be very difficult. But how long a process was the Mandarin one?
Well, yeah, I mean, the both of them are connected in a way. So I would have never known. I wasn't good at languages in school or anything. And the learning the Irish language project was a little bit more motivated by the fact that I knew that Irish people would find it interesting because they all have to learn it at school, but none of them learn it well, and they all sort of resent it. So I knew I was jumping into something that was going to connect with everybody. But as it turned out, I was really good at learning the language, and I was very successful in, you know, doing stand-up, and it was kind of like a, you know, it was just such an interesting experience for me. So I had also had this slight obsession about China. I had been there a couple of times. I'm from Flushing, Queens. I mean, that doesn't mean anything to the Chicago listeners, but it's completely Chinese nowadays, and okay. I had sort of watched that happen in my lifetime. So I really did want to learn the Chinese language, and this was a really good way to do it. Plus, I thought, when I initially started pitching it, it was 2008. It was leading up to the Beijing Olympics, so there was a lot of international focus on China. But I actually didn't get the funding for the project until 2013. So the Chinese thing, see, the Chinese is obviously more difficult to learn than Gaelic, but the immersion experience is so much greater in China in that so few people can speak English, and you really have to use the language as quick as possible when you learn it. So I actually think that I learned Chinese quicker, and I got better at Chinese in the period of time that I had of 1 year.
Okay.
Because you just get a chance to use it so much more.
So
remember, when you're in the Irish-speaking area of Ireland, everybody can speak English. So they're literally sitting there going, like, okay, come on, what are you trying to say? You know, they really have to have patience with you. Whereas in China, if you can't speak the language, then you can't communicate, for the most part. So that does help you to learn the language pretty quick.
And your Irish
project...
And then
the next challenge is... Well, go ahead.
Oh, no, it's the next... What's the next challenge? Is being
able
to use it.
Them laugh.
That is very tough. So you're
actually that was easier than I expected because, first of all, they don't have like stand up as we know it.
Okay,
so it was quite novel for them. I mean, there were some young guys that were trying it out, but in general, it was quite novel for them to sort of see this freewheeling sort of Western style of comedy. And because they were so open to my stories, essentially I was going back to the beginning of my career, total fish out of water. They were so open to my stories of how I perceived China.
Yeah.
Once it wasn't critical, you know, once it was fun, that actually it was easier than I thought. I mean, I was really able to get some pretty good belly laughs once I had a halfway decent command of the language.
That's amazing. As I said, it's hard enough to be funny in your native tongue. Your Irish project, though, they now has been used to try to reevaluate how Gaelic is taught to kids in school, right?
Well, I tried. I mean, after that, I was like really deeply into it for a while, and I actually went to the Minister for Education, and I did try to get the curriculum changed. I mean, it hasn't really changed. I mean, there's been some changes. I don't think they have anything to do with me, but there was some changes where they increased the percentage of how much the oral Irish, you know, like in other words, like how good your speaking is. They increased the importance of that on the exam. But in general, there hasn't really been that many changes. I mean, it's really a terrible pity. I mean, it doesn't mean much over here, but, you know, they spend all of their elementary school and all of their their high school learning this language, and very few leave with any level of fluency, which I just feel like it's a total waste. I mean, you could literally just show movies from these kids from the age of 6 to the age of 18. Just show them movies every time they sit down in Irish and get a better result than what they get, you know, the way that they teach it. But, you know, in terms of, you know, it's the same with kids in American schools learning Spanish. I mean, it's really taught badly, you know. The way that people would get a proficiency in speaking the language it would not be the way that they teach it. But unfortunately, it's very hard to evaluate that. And since we're such a testing culture, you know, the only way to do it is to test you on the grammar and test you on all these things.
Right.
And unfortunately, that doesn't lead to fluency.
No, and that's, you know, people have trouble learning all kinds types of languages through that situation. Now, Des, you mentioned you work all over the country, or all over the world, Australia, Ireland, China. You're coming to Chicago. What's the main differences between an American audience and international audiences?
Yeah, I mean, for me personally, I don't find that many, but that's because I guess I've become a bit desensitized to the differences.
Right.
Like, I just, in each place, I figure it out. And you know, I find American audiences pretty willing to laugh. Like, they're pretty supportive. There's definitely a little more whooping, you know? There's a little bit more sort of, like, cheering sort of thing at an American show. I mean, I'll tell you where you get a big difference. For example, like, I do the Melbourne International Comedy Festival, mm-hmm. and that city is just very left-leaning, liberal city. And I'm not being critical of that, but you can feel the difference when you're at the Melbourne Comedy Festival to the Sydney Comedy Festival. Now, that's just one country. But
right.
For whatever reason, the Melbourne crowd are definitely a little more uptight and also right on. Now, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with being right on. I mean, in a way, it kind of leans towards my politics, really. However, in a comedy club, sometimes that can just feel a bit stiff, you know? Yeah. So I think maybe some American comics that do more of the American road would probably say the same things. Different cities have,
sure.
you know,
yeah, sort different of regions,
different fields.
Different...
Or actually, the guys say it. Like, in Manhattan, there's a certain vibe, and then in Brooklyn, there's a different vibe.
Right.
But in terms of country to country, I haven't found that much. I mean, I really enjoy going on the road in America. You know, don't get me wrong. I love doing gigs here in New York City, and it's fun. But there is something great about, you know, just being in, like, you know,
well,
I'm in Minnesota,
Chicago,
for example. I'm
yeah.
in Minneapolis the week before I go to Chicago, and I just can't wait to talk to these people who, in a way, I have no connection to, really, other than the fact that I'm American.
Right.
But I don't know the experience of Minnesota. And I just love going there and making them laugh, and just, you know, like, the universality of the things we talk about. Those are the shows that I enjoy the most. And I have found those crowds to be the most sort of into it slash sort of willing to laugh, because I think that, you know, I think sometimes, like, in the more urban cosmopolitan areas, people are kind of a bit cynical, you know?
Yeah, well, we're looking forward to seeing you January 9th through the 12th at Zany's Downtown. DesBishop.net is the website. You're a fascinating guy, man. I look forward to talking to you when you come to town.
Oh, thank you so much. Thanks for having me on
Take
the show.
Take care, Des. My pleasure. All right, that is Des Bishop. You can see him at Zany's Downtown January 9th through the 12th.